Mr. Chief Justice, as all senators do return to the chamber, I believe now we're going to go through a segment where we will hear from three of the managers, Congressman Gikas, Shepard, and Cannon, and we will take another break shortly after 3:30.
The chair recognizes Mr. Manager Gikas.
Mr. Chief Justice, counsel for the President, colleagues from the House, and members of the Senate, up to now you have been fully informed of the state of the record in this case, in many different ways, from very many different tonalities uttered by the managers who so magnificently, in my judgment, wove the story that began in 1997 and ended not yet. But that narrative that the managers were able to produce for you and put on the record has met, even as we speak, with commentary in the public that we've all known all of this before. But the big difference is that now it is part of the history of the country. It is lodged in the records of the Senate of the United States. And together with the congressional record of the proceedings that preceded these, those in the House, we now have the dawning of the final chapters of this particular incident involving the President, in which you will have the final word. But that's what the importance was of what you have heard up to now, the complete record woven together step by step so that no one in this chamber at this juncture does not know all the facts that are pertinent to this case. That is a magnificent accomplishment on the part of the managers. But the record is not yet complete. And that is where I and Representative Shepard, Representative Cannon, and Representative Barr come in, so that now we can take the next step in fulfillment of the record, and that is to try to apply the statutory laws, the laws of our nation, as they obtain to the facts that you now have well ingrained into your consciousness. And to do that, we have to repeat some of the facts. Some of these matters overlap. And so the attention that you've given to the matters at hand up to now, your undivided attention, is needed continuously. For instance, we cannot discuss even the application of these statutes to the facts unless we repeat the series of events that catapulted us to this moment in history. And we must begin, as you have heard countless times now, on and off this floor, we must begin with, in my judgment, with the Supreme Court of the United States, with all due deference to the Chief Justice. Because the Supreme Court, at one point in this saga, determined in a suit brought by Paula Jones that indeed an average day-to-day ordinary citizen of our nation would have the right to have a day in court, as it were, even against the President of the United States. It is there that all of this began. Because that fellow American, Paula Jones, no matter how she may have been described by commentators and pundits and talking heads, etc., did have a bundle of rights at her command. And those rights went even to the core of our system of justice to bring the president into the case as a defendant. That is an awesome, a grand result of the Supreme Court decision at that juncture. And this is what is being overlooked, in my judgment, as we pursue why we believe that if perjury indeed was committed, and the record is replete that is, in fact it was, if indeed obstruction of justice was finally committed by the President of the United States, as the evidence is abundant to demonstrate, then we must apply the rights of Paula Jones to what has transpired. We are not saying that the President, even though the weight of the evidence demonstrates it amply, should be convicted of the impeachment which has brought us to this floor because he committed perjury, just because he committed perjury or obstructed justice, but because as a result of his actions, both in rendering falsehoods under oath, as the evidence demonstrates amply, or in obstructing justice, that because of his conduct, he attempted to, or succeeded in, or almost succeeded in, and doesn't matter which of these results finally emerges, attempted to destroy the rights of a fellow American citizen. That is what the gravamen of all that has occurred up to now really is. In attempting to obstruct justice, we mean by that obstructing the justice of whom? It was an attempt, a bold attempt, one that succeeded in some respects, to obstruct the justice sought by a fellow American citizen. That is heavy. That is soul-searching in its quality. That goes beyond those who would say he committed perjury about sex, so what? That goes beyond saying this is just about sex, so what? Everybody lies about sex. But when you combine all the features of the actions of the President of the United States and you see that they are funneled and tunneled and aimed and targeted towards obliterating from the landscape the rights of Paula Jones, a fellow American citizen, then you must take a second look at your own assertion that, so what? It's just a question of fact about sex. Many of the members of this chamber and the others have already acknowledged that the President has lied under oath. But then they're quick to add that, so what, which is so disturbing in view of the results of what has happened in this case. When before the House of Representatives, and it's part of your record, we had a group of academicians, professors testifying, Professor Higginbotham, who since, sadly, I must relate, has passed away since his appearance then, was trying to show how futile it was for us to even attempt to append perjury to an indictable, prosecutable offense that nowhere in the country is it prosecuted regularly and is so trivial because it's based on sex. He went on to give a kind of an example of how trivial it is. Would you expect, he was asking us, and I'm paraphrasing him, I know, would you expect to indict the President of the United States for perjury if he lied that in a 55-mile speed limit, even though he was going 56, that he would say, I was only going 51. Would you indict him on that? In the repartee that I had with him at that juncture, I asked him, would he feel the same if as a result of that perjurious testimony about only going 51 miles an hour, that there was a victim in the case, that this might be a tort case, an involuntary manslaughter case, a negligence case in which someone died as a result of an automobile accident case, and the issue at hand would be the speed limit. Would he feel the same way if, as a result of the perjury committed as to the rate of speed, that someone's rights were erased from the case by virtue of that perjury? The gentleman acknowledged that that made a difference, and that's what the difference is here. The perjury per se, if that be a phrase that we lawyers can adopt, the perjury per se is almost a given, pursuant to the commentary that we've heard from people in and out of this chamber. But when you add to it the terrible consequence of seeing a fellow citizen pursuing justice thwarted, stopped in her tracks, as it were, by reason of the actions of the president. That is what the core issue here is. And to take it then from the status of what consequence it had to that fellow American citizen to the next step is, in my judgment, an easier one, to go to the determination of whether or not there was an impeachable offense. My colleagues will show you how the law of perjury and the law of obstruction of justice fit into this pattern of a factual circumstance that we bring to you. But in the meantime, we must recount, even at the risk of overlapping in some of the testimony, that following the initial recognition by the president that there was going to be a witness list and that Monica Lewinsky would eventually appear as she did on that witness list, this occurred, which is little examined thus far in the world of the scandal in which we're all participants. And that is this. The first item of business on the part of the Jones lawyers in pursuing the rights of Paula Jones was to issue a set of interrogatories, a discovery procedure that is well recognized in our courts all over the land. A set of interrogatories arrives at the president's desk. At this juncture, this is way before the president appeared at the depositions about which you know everything now. The facts have been related to you in 100 different ways, and you know that pretty well. I know you do. But did you know, can you fasten your attention for a moment, knowing that this happened in depositions on a month before, on December the 23rd, 1997, when the president had in front of him were interrogatories that said, that asked, did he ever have sexual relations with anyone other than his spouse during the time that he was governor of Arkansas or president of the United States? And there the president answered, I think that the interrogatory stated, name any persons with whom you've had sexual relations other than your wife. And the answer that the president rendered in those interrogatories under oath was none. I say to the ladies and gentlemen of the Senate that this was the first falsehood stated under oath, which became a chain reaction of falsehoods under oath and even without the oath, all the way to the nuclear explosion of falsehoods that were uttered in the grand jury in August of 1998. This little innocuous piece of paper called interrogatories was placed before the president, presumably with or without counsel, but let's even presume with counsel. And it was a straight question, not with any definitions, no confusing colloquy between a judge and a gaggle of lawyers, no interpretation being put on any particular word in the interrogatories, but whether or not sexual relations had been urged or participated in by the President of the United States, and the answer was none in naming those persons. What does that mean to you? Does that not mean to you that when confronted right at the outset with the phrase sexual relations that the president adopted and determined the common usage, well understood definition of sexual relations that everybody in America recognizes as being the true meaning of sexual relations, meaning sex of any kind? Did not the president answer that under the common understanding that all of us entertain when we discuss, if more so in the last year than ever before in our lives, the phrase sexual relations? To me, that's a telling feature in this case, because when you leap over that and get to the depositions, and everything that the president might have said in those depositions, as his counsel have repeatedly asserted to us, was true, that he did not lie, that he did not commit perjury, that he did not evade the truth, that some of it was puzzling to them even, but that it did not amount to perjury. Can they say that about the statement 1 month before on December 23rd in the interrogatories? That's extremely important. Now, that is my recollection. Yours is the one that will have to predominate, of course. But the weight that I put on it, I urge you to at least evaluate as you begin to level your weight on the evidence that has been presented. And if that were not enough, on January the 15th, again, before the deposition, another interrogatory, this one a request for documents, was submitted to the president. And again, the questioning there was, and you'll see it in the record, it's in the record, the request for documents says to submit anything that pertained to Monica Lewinsky, the intern or employee Monica Lewinsky, of whatever description, notes, gifts, whatever. And the president in that particular instance again said none. I'm willing to give the president a reasonable doubt on that, and even ask you, if you don't place as much weight on it as I do, to forget all about that. But the point is that these assertions under oath were made before the Jones deposition was ever even conceived, let alone undertaken on January the 17th. And so the president cannot use the lawyer talk and judge banter and the descriptions and definitions of sexual relations to cloud the answers that he gave at that time. And all of this in the continuous effort to destroy the rights of Paula Jones, a fellow American citizen. That brings up the question, if someone, a member of your family, or someone who is a witness to these proceedings, had a serious case in which one's self, one's property, one's family has been severely damaged, would you suffer without a whimper perjurious testimony given against you, which you know down deep that at the end of the day has caused you to lose your chance at retribution, at a chance to be compensated for damages, to restore your family life? Isn't that what our system is all about? Isn't that what the adverse consequence is of the attempt to obliterate the Paula Jones civil suit? That's what it is. Not he committed perjury, so what? It is what the end result of that perjury might be that you should weigh. Skip over the fact that he committed perjury. We all acknowledge that, it is said. But now, tell me what that does to Paula Jones, or potentially could do to Paula Jones, or to one of you, or to one of your spouses, or to one of a member of your community who wants to have justice done in the courts. Obstruction of justice is obstruction of justice to an individual or to a family. You can take from Paula Jones and telescope it upwards to every community and every courthouse and every state and every community in our land. And there is a Paula Jones eager to assert certain rights and then be confronted with someone who would tear it down by false testimony, by lies under oath. That is what the gravamen of all of this really is. One more thing. The counsel for the president have repeatedly and very authoritatively and professionally have asserted, as many of you have, that this is not an impeachable offense. For after all, they say, an impeachable offense is one in which there is a direct attack on the system of government, not perjury, not obstruction of justice. So what on those, they imply? They say it does not, perjury, especially about sex, attack the system of government. I must tell you that as an 8 or 9 or 10 year old, I would accompany my mother to naturalization school 3 or 4 nights a week, where my mother was intent on learning the English language and learning about the history of the United States as the teachers for naturalization were preparing these prospective citizens. And she was so proud that she learned that the first president of the United States was George Washington and was prepared to answer that question if it was posed to her at naturalization court. And she was so proud when I was testing her and preparing her. Each time I said, Mom, what are the 3 branches of government? And she would say, the exec and the legislative and the judish, in her wonderful, lovable accent. She knew the system of government. And she did have to answer that at naturalization court. And she knew that the one wall of the 3 that protect our rights is the judish. She knew that the courthouse and the rights of citizens, which are advanced in that courthouse, are the system of government. Can anyone say that purposely attempting to destroy someone's case in the courthouse is not an attack on the system of government of our country? Mr. Chabot will elucidate on perjury.
The chair recognizes Mr. Manager Chabot.
Mr. Chief Justice, senators, distinguished counsel for the President, I'm Steve Chabot, and I represent the 1st District of Ohio. Prior to my election to Congress, I practiced law in Cincinnati for about 15 years. As I stand before you today, I must admit that I feel a long way away from that small neighborhood law practice that I had. But while this arena may be somewhat foreign to me, the law remains the same. As one of the managers who represents the House, I am here to summarize the law of perjury. While today's discussion of the law may not be as captivating as yesterday's discussion of the facts, it is nevertheless essential that we thoroughly review the law as we move forward in this historic process. I will try to lay out the law of perjury as succinctly as I can without using an extraordinary amount of the Senate's time, but I beg you to indulge me. In the United States Criminal Code, there are 2 perjury offenses. The offenses are found in Section 1621 and 1623 of Title 18 of the United States Criminal Code. Section 1621 is the broad perjury statute, which makes it a federal offense to knowingly and willfully make a false statement about a material matter while under oath. Section 1623 is the more specific perjury statute, which makes it a federal offense to knowingly make a false statement about a material matter while under oath before a federal court or before a federal grand jury. It is a well-settled rule that when 2 criminal statutes overlap, the government may charge a defendant under either one. As you know, the President's false statements covered in the 1st impeachment article
were made before a federal grand jury. Therefore, Section 1623 is the most relevant statute. However, Section 1621 is applicable as well. The elements of perjury. There are four general elements of perjury. They are an oath, an intent, falsity, and materiality. I'd like to walk you through each of those elements at this time. First, the oath. The oath need not be administered in any particular form, but it must be administered by person or body legally authorized to do so. In this case, there has been no serious challenge made to the legitimacy of the oaths administered to the president, either in his civil deposition in the Jones versus Clinton case or before the federal grand jury. Let's once again witness President Clinton swearing to tell the truth before a federal grand jury.
I do.
The oath element has clearly been satisfied in this case. The next element is intent. To this day, the president has refused to acknowledge what the vast majority of Americans know to be true, that he knowingly lied under oath. The president's continued inability to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth has forced this body, this jury, to determine the president's true intent. The intent element requires that the false testimony was knowingly stated and described. This requirement is generally satisfied by proof that the defendant knew his testimony was false at the time it was provided. As with almost all perjury cases, you will have to make a decision regarding the president's knowledge of his own false statements, based on the surrounding facts, and yes, by circumstantial evidence. This does not in any way weaken the case against the president. In the absence of an admission by the defendant, relying on circumstantial evidence is virtually the only way to prove the crime of perjury. The federal jury instructions, which federal courts use in perjury cases, can provide helpful guidance in understanding what is meant by the requirement that the false statement must be made knowingly. Let me quote from the federal jury instructions. When the word knowingly is used, it means that the defendant realized what he was doing and was aware of the nature of his conduct and did not act through ignorance, mistake, or accident. So as you reflect on the president's carefully calculated statements, remember the federal jury instructions and ask a few simple questions. Did the president realize what he was doing, what he was saying? Was he aware of the nature of his conduct? Or did the president simply act through ignorance, mistake, or accident? The answers to these questions are undeniably clear, even to the president's own attorneys. In fact, Mr. Ruff and Mr. Craig testified before the Judiciary Committee that the president willfully misled the court. Let's listen to Mr. Ruff.
But did he lie?
I'm going to respond to your question. I have no doubt that he walked up to a line that he thought he understood. Reasonable people, and you maybe have reached this conclusion, could determine that he crossed over that line and that what for him was truthful but misleading or non-responsive and misleading or evasive was in fact false.
In an extraordinary admission, the president's own attorney has acknowledged the care, the intention, the will of the president to say precisely what he said. The president's actions speak volumes about his intent to make false statements under oath. For example, the president called his secretary, Betty Curry, within hours of concluding his civil deposition and asked her to come to the White House the following day. President Clinton then recited false characterizations to her about his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. As you've already heard, Ms. Curry testified that the president made the following statements to her. You were always there when she was there, right? We were never really alone. You could see and hear everything. Monica came on to me, and I never touched her, right? She wanted to have sex with me, and I can't do that. This is not the conduct of someone who believed he had testified truthfully. It is not the conduct of someone who acted through ignorance, mistake, or accident. Rather, it is the conduct of someone who lied, knew he had lied, and needed others to modify their stories accordingly. Finally, it is painstakingly clear during the president's grand jury testimony that he again knows exactly what he's doing. Let's again watch the following excerpt from that testimony.
It was an utterly false statement. Is that correct?
It depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Yes.
In this instance, and in many others that have been presented to you over the last 2 days, the facts and the law speak plainly. The president's actions and demeanor make the case that President Clinton knowingly and willfully lied under oath in a grand jury proceeding and in a civil deposition. The compelling evidence in this case satisfies the intent element required under both sections 1621 and 1623 of the Federal Criminal Code. The next element, falsity. The next element of perjury is falsity. In order for perjury to occur in this case, the president must have made one or more false statements. Yesterday, my colleagues went through the evidence on this matter in great detail and clearly demonstrated that the president did, in fact, make false statements while under oath. Because of the evidence that was presented to date, without question, the president's falsity and his false statements have been shown, so I'm going to move forward to the final element of perjury, which is materiality. The test for whether a statement is material, as stated by the Supreme Court in Cungies versus United States, is simply whether it had a natural tendency to influence or was capable of influencing the official proceeding. The law also makes clear that the false statement does not have to actually impede the grand jury's investigation for the statement to be material. The law regarding the materiality of false statements before a grand jury is very straightforward. Because a grand jury's authorities to investigate is broad, the realm of declarations regarded as material is broad. The president's false statements to the grand jury were material because the grand jury was investigating whether the president had obstructed justice and committed perjury in his civil deposition. Now, let's look at potential legal smoke screens. The president's attorneys will try to distract you from the relevant law and facts in this case. To help you stay focused on the law, I would like to preview some of the arguments that may be made by the president's attorneys. Legal smokescreen number one, the Braunston case. You will probably hear opposing counsel argue that the president did not technically commit perjury and appeal to the case of Braunston versus United States. This is a legal smokescreen. In the Braunston case, the Supreme Court held that statements that are literally truthful and non-responsive cannot by themselves form the basis for perjury conviction. This is the cornerstone of the president's defense. However, the court also held that the unresponsive statements must be technically true in order to prevent a perjury conviction. Such statements must not be capable of being conclusively proven false. As we've seen, none of the president's perjurious statements before the grand jury covered in the first impeachment article are technically true. So when the president's counsel cites the Braunston case, remember the facts and ask yourselves, are the president's answers literally true? And remember, to be literally true, they must actually be true. It is also important to note that, consistent with the Braunston case, the response, "I don't recall," is not technically true if the president actually could recall. The factual record in the case, consisting of multiple sworn statements contradicting the president's testimony and highly specific corroborating evidence, demonstrates that the president's statements were not literally true or legally accurate. On the contrary, the record establishes that the president repeatedly lied, he repeatedly deceived, he repeatedly feigned forgetfulness. There are other clear and important limitations on the Braunston case's scope. In U.S. versus Dzarn, handed down just 3 months ago by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, the court made an important ruling that is directly on point in this case. The Court of Appeals stated, and I quote, "Because we believe that the crime of perjury depends not only upon the clarity of the questioning itself, but also upon the knowledge and reasonable understanding of the testifier, President Clinton, as to what is meant by the questioning, we hold that a defendant may be found guilty of perjury if a jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt from the evidence presented that the defendant knew what the question meant and gave knowingly untruthful and materially misleading answers in response." The Braunston case has further limitations. For example, in United States versus Swindle, the court held that the jury can convict for perjury even if the questions or statements involved are capable of multiple interpretations, where only one interpretation is reasonable under the circumstances surrounding their utterance. In United States versus Doherty, the court held that the prosecution for perjury is not barred under Braunston, and I quote, "whenever some ambiguity can be found by an implausibly strained reading of the question posed." I would submit to this body that implausibly strained reading of the questions posed is precisely what confronts us time and again in the case of the president before the grand jury. Legal smokescreen number two, the two-witness rule. In the coming days, you may hear opposing counsel argue that the president did not commit perjury by appealing to the so-called two-witness rule. Again, this is nothing but a legal smokescreen. This common law rule requires that there be either two witnesses to a perjurious statement, or in the alternative, that there be one witness and corroborating evidence of the perjury. Opposing counsel may suggest that because there were not two witnesses present for some of the president's false statements, he did not technically commit perjury. Such an appeal to the two-witness rule is wrong for several reasons. First, the two-witness rule is not applicable under Section 1623, only under 1621. The language of 1623 expressly provides, and I quote, "it shall not be necessary that such proof be made by any particular number of witnesses or by documentary or other type of evidence." Congress passed Section 1623 back in 1970 to eliminate the two-witness requirement and to facilitate the prosecution of perjury and enhance the reliability of testimony before federal courts and federal grand juries. The legislative history establishes this as the fundamental purpose of the statute. Additionally, substantial evidence has been presented over the last 2 days to satisfy the requirements of the two-witness rule under Section 1621. Remember, when the two-witness rule applies, it does not actually require two witnesses. Indeed, it requires either two witnesses or one witness and corroborating evidence. As you know, there is a witness to each and every one of the president's false statements, and there is voluminous evidence which corroborates the falsehood of his statements. Finally, case law tells us that the two-witness rule is not applicable under certain circumstances when the defendant falsely claims an inability to recall a material matter. Another possible legal smokescreen, the drafting of Article 1, Article 1 being the first article of impeachment. As you know, impeachment Article 1 says that, and I quote, "contrary to that oath, William Jefferson Clinton willfully provided perjurious, false, and misleading testimony to the grand jury." You may hear opposing counsel argue that Section 1621 is the only applicable statute because the article of impeachment accuses the president of willfully committing perjury. This is another legal smokescreen. Following that reasoning, one could just as easily make the argument that 1623 was contemplated here because the term false does not appear in 1621, but does appear in 1623. However, that's not the point. The point is that the language of the impeachment article did not use these terms as terms of art as they are defined and used in various criminal statutes. While the article of impeachment does not draw a distinction between the standards, evidence has been presented over the last 2 days that demonstrates that the president did knowingly and willfully lie under oath regarding material matters before a grand jury. And that satisfies both 1623 and 1621. Again, in the context of perjury law, the distinction between a knowing falsehood and a willful falsehood is almost a distinction without a difference. In American Surety Company versus Sullivan, the Second Circuit stated that the word willful, even in a criminal statute, means no more than the person charged with the duty knows what he is doing. So that, in essence, is the law of perjury. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate, throughout this long and difficult process, apologists for the president have maintained that his actions might well have been reprehensible, but are not necessarily worthy of impeachment and removal from office. I would submit, however, that telling the truth under oath is critically important to our judicial system, and that perjury, of which I believe a compelling case is being made, strikes a terrible blow against the machinery of justice in this country. The President of the United States, the chief law enforcement officer of this land, lied under oath. He raised his right hand and he swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and then he lied, pure and simple. Why is perjury such a serious offense? Under the American system of justice, our courts are charged with seeking the truth. Every day, American citizens raise their right hands in courtrooms across the country and take an oath to tell the truth. Breaking that oath cripples our justice system. By lying under oath, the president did not just commit perjury, an offense punishable under our criminal code, but he chipped away at the very cornerstone of our judicial system. The first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Jay, eloquently stated why perjury is so dangerous over 200 years ago. On June 25th, 1792, in a charge to the grand jury of the Circuit Court for the District of Vermont, the Chief Justice said, and I quote, "Independent of the abominable insult which perjury offers to the divine being, there is no crime more extensively pernicious to society